I had learned to make the most of present pleasures, to forget the miseries of another day. But this answer was a mistake. Well, that's fine for you. For us it's another story. Your mother really has a hard time scraping our meals together. Life is far from easy. I didn't know what to say to this. I thought of giving him back the package. Well, my father said, let's help, it's all over quickly. Things are going badly for the Germans. On London radio all we hear is the Americans here, the Americans there. Italy. The Allies. This was all news to me. A group of men from the Kriegsmarine passed by, singing. I saluted, as required. My father stared at me with dismay. France was in such a state of chaos, and talking about it filled him with such despair that it was very hard to cheer him up. For the next 24 hours, he told me about the suffering in France, explaining things to me as if I were Canadian or English. All of this put me in a very difficult position, and I didn't know quite what attitude to adopt. I held myself in check, contenting myself with yes, papa. Exactly, papa. I would have loved to talk about something else, to have forgotten the war, to have told him that I loved Paula. But I was afraid he wouldn't understand, that he might even be angry. The next day I took my sorrowing father to the station. I was fool enough to snap to attention as the train pulled out, a gesture which I'm sure gave him no pleasure. I watched his anxious face pull away from me, into the hot June evening. I wouldn't see him again for 2 years, 2 years so full of experience they might as well have been a century. As soon as my father was gone, I ran to the Newbucks. I excused myself for not having introduced him, explaining that we had only been together for a very short time. They understood perfectly, and were not in the least offended. As I was clearly bursting with impatience, Frau Newbuck gave me news of Paula. I was extremely disappointed to learn that she would be away until the afternoon of the following day. This was hard to bear. We had already lost 24 hours plus a day and a night, in the 7 or 8 days I had left. This counted for a great deal. I ate with the Newbucks, maintaining a gloomy silence which they understood and respected. Then I left them, to walk the streets, in the hope of meeting my love. I walked for about an hour, until the air raid sirens drowned out the clocks, which were just striking 11. The city filled with the sound of their long drawn-out howling, and the few lights which had remained in the blacked-out streets disappeared. Our fighters were already climbing into the black sky above Tempelhof. The roar of their engines swept over the rooftops, and their trailing exhaust left occasional pink traces in the darkness. The sidecars of the territorial defense were plowing through the streets, urging the few pedestrians to take shelter. I was still on the street, obsessed by a single idea, when we were suddenly enveloped in the heavy throb of enemy bombers. I knew that the first aid teams would turn out as the first bombs began to fall, and that perhaps then I would see Paula. I slid into a doorway opposite the entrance to a shelter under a low building beside a canal. I could see quite far down the canal to a large horizon washed in light fog. The sky to the northwest glowed in the light of an improbable-looking curtain of fire, which was probably concentrated on the big Spandau factories. Everywhere, little points of light crackled like fireworks. The numerous anti-aircraft guns defending the capital, some of them firing from the terraces of houses, were erecting a lethal barricade against the approaching rain of death. Each brilliant light flaming suddenly in the sky and then falling to earth marked the death of an enemy plane. A thudding and hammering of incredible violence shocked the wall of the stone porch against which I had pressed myself, forcing my eyes to accept the brutal contrast between the darkness and flashes of light. I stared down the street and along the quay, where a few laggards were still running for shelter. Then a cacophony of breaking glass marked the blanket of bombs falling across a section of the city about a mile ahead of me. A hurricane of displaced air ran over the surface of the canal, whose water responded in a pattern of sinister waves. I could hear thousands of objects falling all around me. In spite of my intense desire to stay in the street, an irresistible fear made me run to the shelter. The pavement trembled under my feet like a piece of badly attached plating on the hood of a moving truck. In no time, I was in the midst of a crowd of desperate, anxious people. The atmosphere was suffocating. A loud roaring which seemed to emanate with equal strength from above and below shook loose pieces of plaster from the ceiling. People looked for some reassurance on faces as tense with fear as their own. Children asked questions of childish innocence, "What's making that noise, Mama?" while the mothers caressed the small blonde heads with trembling fingers. The lucky ones, who believed in some god, prayed. I was leaning against a pipe which transmitted every sound and vibration from the street. The roaring noise grew suddenly louder, crushing the air in our lungs. The room filled with cries of pain, and then with an intensified din, like the sound of 1,000 locomotives. Horrifying screams of terror, like screams from hell, rang through the darkness. The electric lights came on. Then the entire shelter filled with thick black dust, which poured in from the outside and engulfed us. We could hear some men shouting, "Shut the door!" The door slammed. We felt trapped in a communal grave. Some of the women broke down from nervous tension and began to howl and wave their arms wildly. We felt the floor shake 5 or 6 times, as if in the grip of some overpowering force. We were all terrified, and clung together, despite a hideous sense of suffocation. An hour later, when the storm seemed to have died down, we left that ghastly hole. We were confronted by a scene worthy of Dante. The dark waters of the canal reflected the numerous fires ravaging its banks and destroying the structures which had given it some point. What was left of the tidy street and its white-edged sidewalks lay strewn with rubble between two giant crevasses. A constellation of sparks ascended into the summer sky in a rising column of acrid, suffocating smoke. People were running everywhere, and as at Magdeburg I was immediately impressed into a clean-up squad. After an exhausting night, and most of the next morning, I finally found Paula, who was just as done in as I. The happiness I felt when she told me she had worried about me during the bombing erased the miseries of the night in a single stroke. I was thinking of you too, Paula. I looked for you all night long. Really? She asked, in a tone which told me that her sentiment was as strong as mine. I felt giddy with emotion. My eyes remained fixed on the young girl before me. I wanted passionately to take her in my arms, and knew that I was blushing. She broke the silence. I feel like a limp rag, she said. Why don't we go out to the country? Somewhere around Tempelhof. It might make us feel better. That's a good idea, Paula. Let's go. I rode out with my first love in a little motorcycle taxi to the sandy countryside near the civil and military airfield at Tempelhof. We left the Autobahn and climbed onto a small hillock covered with a kind of spongy lichen onto which we collapsed with delight. We both felt crushed by exhaustion. It was a marvelous day. Less than a mile away the ground was cut up and crisscrossed by the network of airport runways from which Focke-Wulf trainers leapt into the sky with astonishing speed. Paula lay on her back with her eyes closed, as if she were nearly asleep. I leaned on my elbow and stared at her, as if the rest of the world didn't exist. My head was filled with things to say to her 1,000 amorous communications, but my mouth remained ludicrously shut. I felt that I should and must say everything to her right away, that they could wait no longer, that I must take advantage of this ideal moment and make her understand that it was idiotic to be so timid. Perhaps Paula was being deliberately silent, so that I would have a chance to speak. Time was passing, especially the time still left in my leave, but, despite all these considerations, my love for Paula imposed silence. She murmured, "The sun is so hot." I stammered a few stupidities. Finally, in a surge of courage, I slid my hand toward hers. The ends of our fingers touched, and I lingered for a moment at this delicious contact. Then I screwed up my courage so that my breath almost stopped, and Paula's hand was entirely mine. I grasped it fervently, and she didn't try to withdraw it. My shyness had presented me with a problem more taxing than finding a safe passage through a minefield. I lay stretched on my back for a moment longer, recovering my strength. I stared at the sky, overwhelmed with happiness, lost to the rest of the world. Paula turned her face toward me. Her eyes were still closed, and her hand gripped mine. I felt that I might faint. In a fever of emotion, I think I told her I loved her. Then I pulled myself together. I didn't know whether I had spoken or not. Paula hadn't moved. I must have been dreaming. Suddenly, we turned our heads. The air was filled once again with the sinister sound of sirens howling in unison from the airport to the edge of the city. We stared at each other, astounded. Can it be another raid? This seemed unlikely. At that time, daytime raids near the capital were still extremely rare. However, the sirens were impossible to mistake. They were signaling the start of a raid, and we quickly believed them. Planes were rolling down all the runways, gathering speed. The fighters are taking off, Paula. It really is a raid. You're right. Look down, there are all those people running to the shelter. We should get into a shelter too, Paula. But we are perfectly safe here, it's the country. They're going to bumble in again. I guess you're right, we're as well off here as in one of those airless holes. The German fighters roared over our heads. 10. 12. 13. 14, cried Paula, waving at the Focke-Wulfs boring through the air over our heads. Good luck to our pilots. 3 cheers for them. Go on, boys, I shouted, to fall in with her mood. Go on, Paula repeated. It's not night time now, they'll be able to see. 22. 23. 24. How many there are? Hooray! 30 fighters had taken off, and were soaring into the sky. Their tactic was to climb as high as possible, so that they could swoop down on the bombers from above and sting them in the back. The Luftwaffe had perfected the formidable Focke-Wulf 190s and 195s, which could soar up quickly, for precisely this purpose. We could hear the distant firing of anti-aircraft guns. If we catch them that far away, they'll never even get to Berlin, Paula said. I hope not, Paula. I had already forgotten about the damned raid, which had made me drop my girl's hand. Leaving the fighters to look out for themselves, I was preparing a second attack. I was already quite close to Paula, when the roar of enemy bombers drowned out the sounds of the nearby city, and overwhelmed us. Oh, look, Gil, she said, as always mispronouncing my name. They're coming from over the Luck. With her delicate hand, she pointed to a huge mass of black dots which were steadily growing larger against the pale blue sky. How high they are, she said. And look, there are others over there. I stared at the double apparition bearing down on the city and on us. My God, how many there are? The noise grew louder and louder. There must be hundreds of them. It's impossible to count, Paula said. They're still too far away. I began to feel afraid for us, for her, for my happiness. We've got to get away from here, Paula. It could get very dangerous. Oh no, she said, unconcerned. What would happen to us here? We could be strafed, Paula. We've got to find a shelter. I tried to drag her after me. Look, she said, fascinated by the spectacle of danger growing visibly larger. They're coming straight at us. And look at the white trails they make. Isn't it strange? Now our flak went into action. On all sides, thousands of guns were spitting steel at the attackers. Come quick, I said to Paula, tugging her hand. We've got to get to a shelter. The shelters at the airfield were too far away for us now, so I pulled her toward a hollow in the ground, beside a large tree. Where are our fighters? Cried Paula, gasping for breath. Perhaps they've run away, there are so many enemy planes. You mustn't say that. German soldiers never run away. But what can they do, Paula? There must be at least 1,000 bombers. You have no right to say that about our heroic pilots. Forgive me, Paula, you are right. I would be astonished if they ran away. The thunder of bombs once again filled the air of the martyred city. German soldiers never run away. I, who had run from the Don to Kharkov, knew that perfectly well, although it must be admitted that German soldiers could fight against odds as great as 30-1 as in Russia, for instance. From the hole into which Paula and I had dived, we were able to watch the avalanche which flattened a third of the airfield and 90% of Tempelhof. The daytime raids were always stronger than the ones at night. On that particular day, 1,100 British and American planes attacked the Berlin region, opposed by roughly 60 fighters. The heavy American losses were caused largely by flak. At least 100 planes were shot down. The German fighters had not run away, not a single German plane came through undamaged. I can still see very clearly the whistling clusters of bombs falling 7,000 or 8,000 feet onto Tempelhof and the airfield, and feel the earth trembling under their giant blows. I can see the ground cracking, and houses bursting into flame, and the oiled depots near the field spreading the flames over hundreds of yards. I can see a suburb of 150,000 people blotted out in a blanket of smoke. And with my eyes involuntarily wide from the shock, I can see trees tearing upward from the ground in groups of 10 or 12, and hear them ripping open the earth. I can hear doomed planes roaring their engines, and see them spinning, exploding, falling. And I can see the terror in Paula's eyes, as she pressed herself against me. Flaming debris was falling all around us, so we made ourselves as small as we could at the bottom of our hole. Paula hid her face between my shoulder and my cheek, and I could feel her trembling, quite apart from the trembling of the earth. Pressed together like two lost children, we watched helplessly. Long after the planes had gone, delayed action bombs were exploding in Tempelhof, where the raid had taken 22,000 lives. Berlin had received a battering too, and its rescue services were completely overwhelmed. The streets were still strewn with wreckage from the night raid, Spandau was still burning, and in the southwest quarter of the city delayed action bombs were still exploding 15 hours later. Tempelhof was shrieking with pain. When we stumbled from our hole, haggard with exhaustion, Paula clung to my arm. Her nerves were strained to their utmost, and she couldn't stop trembling. "Gil," she said. "I feel terrible. And look at me, I'm filthy." She seemed to have lost control of her reason. Her head fell back on my shoulder. Without even thinking, I kissed her on the forehead. She made no effort to stop me. I was unable to reassemble the thoughts which had obsessed me at the beginning of our walk. I no longer felt any hesitation about kissing my friend. We seemed to have passed beyond the stage of infantile flirting. I kissed her hair as if I were consoling an anxious child, and saw, through her tears, the tears of the child in Magdeburg, shaking with sobs. I thought of Ernst, of all the tears in this war, and all the anguish. I tried to feel pity, and to show it. My happiness was mixed with too much suffering. I couldn't simply accept it, and forget all the rest. My love for Paula seemed somehow impossible, in this setting of permanent chaos. As long as children were crying in the dust of their crumbled homes, I would never be able to live with my love. Nothing seemed certain. Perhaps nothing would survive this marvelous spring day except my love for Paula, and I didn't know how to declare it. Three quarters of the sky was darkened by smoke from the thousands of fires which were burning at Tempelhof, along the autobahns, and in Berlin. I looked from Paula's blonde hair to the ravaged landscape. Once more, we fell down on the grass. I didn't know what to say to comfort her. When we had regained some of our strength, we walked slowly down the autobahn. There, truckloads of rescue workers were driving toward Tempelhof. Without any signal, a truck stopped beside us. "Come on, you young ones. They need you down there." We looked at each other. "Yes. We're just coming. Paula, I'll help you climb up." The trucks were picking up everyone they met. One section of the city was abandoned so that another, at least, might be saved. We worked for hours, pulling out the wounded. The Hitlerjugend from a nearby hostel volunteered for the most dangerous jobs, in search of heroism. Many of them were killed, disappearing in the torrential collapse of burning timber frames. We managed to find refuge late that night, in an apartment that had been three quarters destroyed. Dizzy with fatigue, we collapsed onto a bed, and lay there, too tired to speak, staring into the darkness with wide open eyes. Thousands of luminous butterflies seemed to be dancing in front of us. They looked as solid and tangible as living creatures. My retina, stamped with the lights of the fires, continued to light my inner vision. One of Paula's hands twisted a button on my dusty tunic. "Do you think we can sleep here?" she said. "I don't know, but anyway, if anyone found us here, we might get into trouble." What could she be thinking of? "I don't care. I'm too tired." Paula, who was sucking one of her skinned fingers, said nothing. I slid my hand under her head, and fully prepared to affront God or the devil, pulled her to me, kissing her passionately, as her torn hands stroked my hair. We were trying to catch up with what life had denied us that afternoon, but quickly succumbed to sleep, overcome by exhaustion. We spent all next day cleaning up. It took about a week to restore some kind of functional order. However, in the evening, we were relieved by fresh volunteers, who had been rounded up so that the first group could return to their usual occupations. Luckily for me, I was not impressed into any obligatory duties, although as a soldier on leave I was not involved in any essential activities. 2 more days went by, during which I hardly left Paula's side. Every morning I brought a fresh supply of chocolates and cigarettes from my father's package for us to consume together. The capital was binding up its wounds and burying its dead. Long funeral processions twisted through the streets. The heroic city was returning to its usual productive rhythm. I only had 5 days left, and felt oppressed and anguished by the prospect of departure. Paula, who dreaded it as much as I did, tried to fill my mind with other thoughts. Luckily, there were no further aids. The Nubuks had lost all their windows, and had to repair a section of their roof. 3 bombs had fallen only 150 yards away, on the square, which now looked like a street in Minsk. Paula's mother, whom I had met, began to think it rather strange that her daughter never left my side. We met every evening, as well as every day, but she took the times into account, and raised no objection. Paula, who had more money than I did, took me to the movies one evening. We saw a film called Demon Sea, based on a poem about water lilies. We lived this way until the day of my departure. I was due at the Silesian station at 7 in the evening. The Nubuks were touching in their expressions of goodwill when I said goodbye to them. They understood that I wished to spend my last hours with the girl they considered my fiancé Tilda Copyrightee. Frau Nubuk insisted on giving me a heavy pullover which had belonged to Ernst. Her husband gave me cigars, soap, and 2 boxes of tinned food. They both embraced me, and made me promise to come and see them on my next leave. I assured them I would, and that I'd send them my news from time to time. I asked them to look out for Paula. "You love her, don't you?" Frau Nubuk asked me gently. "Oh yes, Frau Nubuk." Despite an attempt at calm, my voice rang with emotion. I kissed them both, and left. At the reception center, the Feld gave Paula permission to go up to the dormitory with me and help me pack. I could feel my throat knotting with sorrow. How long would it be before I saw Paula again? We repeated over and over again how much we loved each other, and began to feel somewhat calmer. I would certainly have another leave in 3 or 4 months, and Paula, of course, would wait for me. She swore that she would write to me every day, that soon we would belong to each other, that we would marry. Her warm lips murmured this to me 1,000 times as we kissed. "The war must end soon. It can't go on like this. We can't have another horrible winter like the one last year. Everyone had suffered more than enough, and the fighting would have to stop." We felt sure of it. We arrived at the Silesian station, to find that the departure platform had been moved to another position 0.5 mile away because of bomb damage. Paula walked beside me, smiling despite her emotion. She was carrying a package which she wanted to give me at the last minute. The platform was decorated with pennants and flags to salute the long line of men returning to the east. We stopped beside the first carriage of the Poznan train. I shoved my bulging sack inside, and turned back to catch a moment of unguarded sadness on Paula's face. Don't be sad, beloved. I love you so much. I stood for a long time, holding her hands, unable to think of anything else to say. I longed to hold her in my arms, but this was forbidden in public. People walked by, talking. The cement platform rang with the sound of the metal boots of fellows in the same position as myself. But my eyes were glued to Paula. I was oblivious of everyone and everything else. The hour of departure had almost arrived. A shiver ran through my body, and made my hands tremble. A stationmaster in a red cap was walking down the platform calling out the stops ahead: Poznan, Warsaw, Lublin, Lvov, Russia. These words crushed my sense of happiness. I braced myself for the whistle which would interrupt our last moment. Paula. The stationmaster continued his list of distant destinations. Paula. What would it have been without you? Auf Wiedersehen, mein Lieber, Paula whispered, in tears. Paula, I beg you. Don't cry. Please. You know I'll be back soon. Ich weiß, mein Lieber, auf Morgen Gill. A section was tramping by on the other side of the tracks singing gaily, Erika, we love you, Erika, we love you. And that's why we'll come back, that's why we'll come back. You see, Paula. Even the song says so. Listen, I felt overwhelmed by the words. I would come back only for Paula. That's what the song meant to say. Then the whistle demolished my sense of joy. I pulled Paula to me and embraced her wildly. Einstigen. Los. Los. Rise and Einstigen. Achtung. Passagier Einstigen. Achtung, Achtung. I love you, Paula. We'll see each other soon. Don't be sad. See how beautiful it is today. We can't be sad. Paula was inconsolable, and I felt that I was going to burst into tears myself. I kissed her for the last time. The couplings of the carriages clashed, the train was beginning to move. I jumped onto the step of the carriage. Paula clung to my hand. The train slowly gathered speed. Many of the people standing on the platform were crying, and soldiers leaning halfway out the windows were still hanging on to someone's hand, or kissing a child. Paula ran beside us as long as she could. Then she had to let go. See you soon, my love. The day was so beautiful we should have been leaving for a day in the country. I stood on the step for a long time, watching the outline of my beloved growing smaller and smaller, and finally disappearing forever. I will soon come back, Paula. But I never went back. I never saw Paula again, or Berlin, or Killeringstrasse, or the Nubucks. Paula, we'll be married, I swear it. But the war prevented me from keeping my word, and the peace made it lose all its value. France reminded me of that severely enough. So please forgive me, Paula. It wasn't all my fault. You knew the misery of war too, and fear, and anguish. Perhaps, and I wish it with all my heart, perhaps you also were spared. That at least would allow us both to remember. The war destroyed Berlin, and Germany, and Killeringstrasse, and perhaps the Nubucks too, but not you, Paula. That would be too horrible. I have forgotten nothing. Whenever I close my eyes, I relive our marvelous moments, and hear once again the sound of your voice, and smell your skin, and feel your hand in mine. Training for an elite division, off, marsh, marsh. I remained in the corridor of the crowded train, and quickly opened the little box Paula had given me as we parted. It contained two packs of cigarettes which I had given her from my father's parcel. My father wasn't a smoker, and must have collected those cigarettes on odd occasions, for years. Paula had added a short note, and her photograph. In her note, she said that she hoped the cigarettes would help me through some of the hard moments ahead. I must have read her words over at least 10 times before tucking her letter and photograph into my passbook. The train lurched forward. Everyone was wrapped in his private melancholy. I tried to find a relatively stable spot where I could press a piece of paper against the window frame and begin a letter to Paula, but some bastard from the Alpine Corps had to try and talk to me. So, leave's over. Always too short, isn't it? Mine's over too. Now, back to the guns. I looked at him without answering. He was a pain in the neck. And with good weather like this, things must be really rough out there. I can remember that very well from last summer. One day we